This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on today's show, as the EU-Turkey migrant deal takes effect, refugees are arrested, aid groups pull support, and a terror attack in Brussels sparks calls for even tougher restrictions. The International Criminal Court returns two landmark convictions. And the Oklahoma Geological Survey says a dramatic surge in earthquakes in the state is very likely linked to fracking. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. The effects of Tuesday's terror attacks in Brussels continue to ripple across Belgium and beyond. 31 people are confirmed dead and hundreds more injured in the attacks at the Brussels airport and the busy Malbeek metro station. And the death toll may still rise. Officials now say at least 5 people took part in the coordinated suicide bombings. The fate and identities of 2 remain unknown, but 3 attackers are confirmed dead. As with the November attacks in Paris, some European policymakers are using the tragedy to call for further restrictions on refugees fleeing war and poverty in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. The new EU-Turkey migrant deal was still rolling out as the bombs exploded. At least one EU country, Poland, has already reneged on its pledge to resettle Syrian refugees under the new rules. All migrants arriving on Greek shores are now being sent back to Turkey. In turn, the EU is to accept an equal number of Syrians from Turkey for resettlement. Prior to the summary deportation agreement, refugee centers in the Greek Isles were open and migrants were free to come and go. But as of last weekend, Greek authorities are arresting and forcibly detaining people ahead of deportation. That's why Wednesday, Doctors Without Borders joined the UNHCR in ending aid services in what have now become de facto jails. UNHCR spokesperson Melissa Fleming.
Up until now, UNHCR has been supporting the authorities in these so-called hotspots on the Greek islands. But under the new provisions, these so-called hotspots have now become detention facilities. So accordingly, and in line with UNHCR's policy on opposing mandatory detention, we have suspended some of our activities at all the closed centers on the island. And this includes the provision of transport to and from these sites.
The UNHCR will still help migrants on the shoreline, sharing information about the asylum process and advice on family reunification. And they'll maintain a presence at the detention centers to monitor the human rights situation. As arrests increase, so do tensions in refugee encampments across Europe, like the one in Idomeni, where 2 people self-immolated Tuesday amid growing protests. Yet the mass movement of people continues. FSRN's Gabe Matthews is in Afghanistan, where he attended the funeral of 7 members of a single family who died trying to cross the Aegean Sea, and talked with another family who hoped to soon send their son along the same perilous path. Robert Packard reads his report.
It is a gloomy day in Kabul. Dozens of people gathered to bury 7 Afghans who drowned in the Aegean Sea while trying to make the dangerous crossing to Europe. The family is still hoping that the bodies of 5 other relatives also on board the same vessel will turn up. So far, they are still missing in Turkish waters. According to Afghan custom, the mourners will neither speak of the dead before they are buried, nor the reason they were aboard the overcrowded vessel. But a few streets away, more time has passed for the mother of another would-be migrant. Sharifa Omeri's son, Rashid, was killed in Iran 8 months ago while traveling overland trying to reach Europe through Turkey. His body has yet to be returned, and Sharifa has not been able to lay him to rest. She says ever since she learned of his death, time does not pass, and she can hardly control her tears.
I wish I could see his dead body. It would help me to deal with the pain and grief. I wish I'd never allowed him to leave the country. I wish I'd stopped him by force. Now I hope I die soon, too.
Sharifa's husband sold their property to pay for Rashid to travel to Europe. Now, they've lost both their ancestral land and their son. The same day the mourners bury their loved ones, in the capital city of Kabul, hundreds of Afghans stand in line to get their electronic passports. One of them is Mazullah Khan. He says he is 19 years old, but he looks barely 16 and has not yet begun to shave.
My father sold his land to send me to Europe. There are no jobs here, only poverty. So I plan to go to Europe and earn money. I'm ready to work any type of work, labor or any other job, to earn money and support my family. I know it's not easy to reach Europe, and I know about dangers during the trip.
According to the Ministry of Refugees and Repatriations, more than 70,000 Afghans like Mazullah have left the country in the last 3 months alone. Thousands more hope to leave as soon as they can come up with the money, certain they'll find opportunity abroad and be able to send money back home. All told, government officials say 250,000 Afghans have already registered as refugees in developed countries. A survey conducted jointly by the United Nations Refugee Agency and the Afghanistan Research and Evaluation Unit, or RU, found poverty, insecurity, and unemployment as the main driving forces causing Afghan youth to migrate. And the increasing presence of the self-proclaimed Islamic State, who brutally kill innocent civilians, has increased the number of people trying desperately to leave the country. As with both the Omeri and Khan families, parents often sell what little they have to finance the dangerous and uncertain trips. They encourage their children to migrate, hoping they'll find safety and opportunity that they do not have at home. Agents in human trafficking groups make it easy for young Afghans to take the risk. Depending on routes traveled and country of destination, they can cost anywhere from $5,000 to $12,000. Ramin Jan, not his real name, is one such agent. He charges $12,000 to take people to England and says most of his clients are young people.
We have a network of agents. We take people from Western Afghanistan to Iran and then to Turkey. Once there, we hand off our people to an agent who's responsible for the rest of the trip to European countries.
Yet, despite the hope that many feel as they depart, the realities are harsh. Dr. Syed Mahdi Mosawi is a senior research officer with RU. He has spent time in Iran and regularly visits Turkey and says things are not necessarily better for Afghan youth who survive the journey and live as refugees in other countries.
Parents should be informed about the hardships and risks their children will face during their journey. They'll also be left with psychological problems, and our media, TV, and radio should disseminate these messages. Everyone should take it seriously, because this is not an individual issue, but a problem common to us all.
But with little economic opportunity, many families see no options, and even educated young Afghans feel forced to join the mass exodus from the country. This is Robert Packard reading for Gabe Matthews, FSRN, Afghanistan.
The International Criminal Court returned two major verdicts this week in cases ranging from the use of rape as a tool of war to genocide. Tuesday, the ICC convicted the former vice president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Jean-Pierre Bemba. It's the first time the ICC has ruled on rape as a war crime, and also the first time the court has held a military leader accountable for the actions of his subordinates, under a legal theory known as command responsibility. Presiding Judge Sylvia Steiner read from the unanimous court decision.
Rape is a crime against humanity under Article 71G of the statute. Rape is a war crime under Article 82E, small Roman 6 of the statute.
Bemba is the highest-ranking official the court has convicted to date. He commanded the Congolese Liberation Movement, or MLC, between 2002 and 2003 in a failed bid to shore up the Central African Republic's then-president before his eventual ouster. More than 5,000 victims were eligible to participate in the trial as witnesses. 77 testified, describing egregious attacks in which entire families were victimized, including young children and the elderly. At the close of the trial, Judge Steiner said issues related to reparations will be addressed in due course. Then Thursday, the court ruled in another major case, finding former Serb leader Radovan Karadzic guilty of genocide during the 1990s Bosnian War. The court convicted Karadzic on 10 charges related to the ethnic cleansing during the multi-sided war in the former Yugoslavia, including in the Srebrenica massacre, in which troops under his command slaughtered more than 8,000 Muslim men and boys in a matter of days in what had been declared a UN safe zone for civilians. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia sentenced the 70-year-old Karadzic to 40 years in prison. You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org. As President Barack Obama's tenure nears its end, he circled back to an early promise to shut down the military detention center at Guantanamo Bay. This week, that plan got significant pushback on two fronts, from Republicans in the House of Representatives and from Cuban President Raul Castro. Tanya Snyder has more.
So this is what it sounds like when you hold a hearing on closing a prison the day after a terrorist attack.
So the innocent people who are going to lose their lives because of this, they're just part of the equation.
That's California Republican Dana Rohrabacher. He mocked President Obama's assertion that the continued operation of the prison creates conflicts with American allies.
Let me suggest that that attitude of our European friends may well be changing in the next 6 months or so when they realize that the slaughter that's taking place in Paris and now in Brussels is part of an international movement to destroy Western civilization and replace it with a caliphate.
That argument carries a lot of weight with Republicans and some Democrats who are concerned that civilian justice isn't robust enough for the kinds of people detained at Guantanamo, except for one thing.
The continued maintenance of the facility at Guantanamo Bay did not prevent either of those attacks.
That's Lee Woloski, who heads the State Department's program on closing Guantanamo.
There are unfortunately going to be acts of terrorism, probably whether the facility is opened or closed. The proper analysis is what are the risks of keeping it open in light of the very obvious use of that facility as a propaganda tool.
At a House committee hearing on the prison closure plan Wednesday, Woloski had several volleys with Republicans over re-engagement or the number of detainees released from Guantanamo who have gone back to the battlefield. Republicans say as many as 31% have returned to violence. Woloski said that's an outdated figure, and it was only that high if you included unconfirmed cases. Now that number is shrinking dramatically, evidence, he says, that new security procedures are working.
The actual numbers are, in this administration, 7 confirmed reengagement former detainees. In the previous administration, 111. 7 in this administration out of 144 transferred. That translates into 4.9%. The number for the previous administration is 111 out of 532, which translates into 20.9%.
The most controversial element of President Obama's plan to close the prison at Guantanamo is the proposal to house some detainees in supermax prisons in the United States, which the House preemptively banned. About 800 prisoners have gone through Guantanamo, and the vast majority have already been released, most of them under President Bush. Only 91 people remain, and 35 of them have been approved for transfer to other countries. Some of the remaining detainees are still under review as the military commissions try to figure out what to do with them. Lawmakers who insist on military tribunals and military prisons seem to believe that U.S. civilian law is too soft. But Representative Jerry Connolly of Virginia says a terrorist who killed 2 CIA employees in 1993 was convicted in Virginia and executed.
Somehow our system of justice worked. Not on Cuban soil, on Virginian soil. We could handle a terrorist and did.
As lawmakers considered the president's plan to shutter the controversial facility, Obama was in Cuba this week, making inroads on the warming relationship with President Raul Castro, who made clear how he feels about the entire facility at Guantanamo Bay.
También será necesario
In order to move forward toward normalization, he said, it will be necessary to return the territory illegally occupied by the Guantanamo naval base. President Obama didn't mention the prison the whole time he was in Cuba, despite provocations like that one. Had he done so, he may have compromised his moral high ground regarding human rights in Cuba, given the murky U.S. record with respect to Guantanamo. But Obama did say this.
I affirm that Cuba's destiny will not be decided by the United States or any other nation. Cuba is sovereign and rightly has great pride, and the future of Cuba will be decided by Cubans, not by anybody else.
In the interests of Cuban sovereignty, President Castro isn't just demanding that the prison at Guantanamo be closed. He wants the entire base shuttered and the land returned to Cuba. President Obama has said he has no intention of doing that. Tanya Snyder, FSRN in Washington.
In the past year, Oklahoma had more than 900 earthquakes. That's up from only 3 quakes in 2007, before the dramatic increase in fracking in the state. The Oklahoma Geological Survey says that it now, quote, considers it very likely that many of the earthquakes in Oklahoma were caused by the injection of produced water in disposal wells as a byproduct of fracking. Last month, the Sierra Club and Public Justice filed a lawsuit against 3 energy companies, saying they've contributed to the huge upsurge in earthquakes in Oklahoma. Though most of the quakes have been 3 points or less on the Richter scale, residents have started to worry about a big one damaging their homes and even their livelihoods. Some say that in a state economy built on oil and gas, ongoing fracking-related earthquakes could kill the golden goose. FSRN's Larry Buell has more from Oklahoma City.
In Oklahoma, the influence of oil and gas is everywhere. It's not uncommon to see pump jacks in residential neighborhoods. There's even an active oil rig on the Capitol grounds. People are used to the dominance of oil and gas. They're even used to the threat of tornadoes in the spring. What they're not used to is earthquakes. But in recent years, Oklahoma has become the most seismically active state in the lower 48. Now that quakes are hitting densely populated areas, Oklahomans are starting to question their state's lax regulatory environment that's allowed fracking companies of all sizes to set up operations anywhere, like near a fault line.
We wonder who is protecting us. Not the governor.
No.
Not the legislature.
No.
Not the OCC.
No.
That's anti-fracking activist Angela Spotts in a rally captured by documentary filmmaker Taylor Mullins.
What happens when the big quake hits? I don't think people understand across this state how gripping that's going to be if a big one hits. And I think it's coming because we're not doing anything to stop it. We don't have contingency plans in place, and we have been warned.
Hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, injects chemical-laced water under high pressure underground to loosen shale rock and release natural gas. As a part of the process, wastewater is forced back into the ground into deep disposal wells. That can act like a lubricant, making the ground shift. After years of denying it, state officials now acknowledge the link between the injection of fracking wastewater into disposal wells and Oklahoma's surge in earthquake activity. But there's no agreement on what to do about it. In 2014, New York banned all hydraulic fracturing in the state. Pennsylvania has issued tougher regulations on fracking operations. Vermont banned fracking in 2012, mostly due to the fear of chemicals leaching into groundwater, and cities across the country have outlawed the practice. But last year, Oklahoma passed a law prohibiting cities from banning fracking operations. Texas also instituted a similar ban last year after residents of Denton, the birthplace of fracking, voted to ban the practice in a local ballot initiative. Still, some Oklahomans are demanding stronger oversight. Ariel Ross is a visiting professor of English at Oklahoma State University in Stillwater. She's active in the group Stop Fracking Payne County.
You know, we want to make sure everyone is protected from the earthquakes. We feel that the safest way to do that is to place a moratorium on wastewater injection until the situation is much more clearly understood.
Oklahoma's buildings were not designed with seismic activity in mind, especially not the kind that the state is currently experiencing. Property owners who want to retrofit their structures are on their own, and unless they have earthquake coverage and have catastrophic damage, they'll be paying out of pocket. And if the wastewater injection continues triggering quakes, the entire state could be at risk. A 2015 report from Standard & Poor's Rating Services said quakes in Oklahoma and in other states with man-made seismicity linked to oil and gas production will have sharp economic consequences on real estate investment, property values, and job growth. State Representative Corey Williams criticizes lawmakers and the oil and gas industry for not taking adequate preventative measures.
I think that when we have a seismic event that actually causes a significant amount of damage, that will be the tipping point where the industry has kind of harmed itself and public opinion really starts to turn against it.
Williams says there are solutions short of an outright fracking ban, but even those ideas are meeting resistance from industry and legislators.
We could be putting in place a tax credit associated with processing wastewater and recycling wastewater right now. It would have a minimal impact on the state. It allows us to work out the kinks at a good time. We'd be recycling our actually most precious resource, water, and we could roll off the horizontal drilling tax credit, which is no longer needed. We don't need to incentivize that technology, but we just don't really seem to have the political courage to do those things in the state right now.
In 2015, the Oklahoma Corporation Commission, that's the state oil and gas regulator, said it would shut down fracking near the epicenter of any earthquake of 4.0 or above, but only after the second 4.0 quake occurs. That's happened once. But most of the quakes are below 4.0, and some worry that those will have a cumulative effect on structures. Tamara Mix is a professor of environmental sociology and social psychology at Oklahoma State University. Even when the ground isn't shaking, she's reminded of fracking. That's because after she bought her house, a fracking company started drilling just across her property line.
People are not familiar with the nature of the risk. We prepare for tornadoes, but we do not prepare for earthquakes. We prepare for wildfires, but we do not prepare for earthquakes. And so in terms of the hazard risks that are going on here, the stress levels become very significant, and they manifest in different ways here because of the unprecedented nature and the quick increase in which this has happened.
Oklahomans shaken up by quakes can swing between fatalism, anger, fear, and gallows humor. Ariel Ross keeps a bowl of brick fragments that have fallen off her walls.
I don't know why I keep it. I think just as sort of a physical reminder that while I don't necessarily feel endangered here, probably I am. I think we really all are in various ways.
Larry Buell, FSRN, Oklahoma City.
FSRN comes to you free of corporate underwriting or advertising dollars. Listener support is crucial to our continued broadcasts. Find out how you can support our work. Visit our website, fsrn.org. Brazil is reeling from political and economic crises that have left the country shaken and polarized. A 2-year corruption investigation into a kickback scheme at the state oil company, Petrobras, is coming to a head and has already ensnared dozens of the country's business and political elites. However, many charge that the investigation is biased and politically motivated, and that protests are split along class lines. From Sao Paulo, FSRN's Sam Cowie reports.
Eu jamais renunciarei.
Speaking live to a news team and broadcast on national television on Tuesday, Brazil's president, Dilma Rousseff, said that she would never stand down. A crowd cheered, "There will not be a coup." Brazil's current political crisis is highly complex. Broadly speaking, the country is split into two camps. Those who are for and those who are against Rousseff's impeachment. On Avenida Paulista, Sao Paulo's main thoroughfare, pro-impeachment supporters are camped out in front of the headquarters of the Federation of Industries of Sao Paulo, or FIESP, an association of mostly private industrial interests. The organization has declared itself in favor of Rousseff's impeachment because of a proposed tax increase. Ricardo Horki, who owns a key-cutting business in Sao Paulo, is in favor of impeachment and military intervention if necessary. He said he fears that if Rousseff is ousted, there may be some kind of counter-coup attempt by government supporters, making comparisons with Venezuela in 2002.
Today, the left wing is the same as in 1964, when they wanted to implement communism here, similar to what Fidel Castro did in Cuba. Now, they want Brazil to be like Venezuela, communism with a capitalist facade. In reality, it's just robbery. Not capitalism nor communism, just robbery.
Rousseff is facing impeachment for allegedly mismanaging federal budgets. Her supporters point out that the impeachment charge is led by lower house speaker Eduardo Cunha, himself facing graft charges. Those against impeachment also maintain that democracy in Brazil is under threat and say it's illegal and unconstitutional to impeach a president who hasn't committed a crime. The country has recently seen huge pro- and anti-impeachment protests. Surveys show that the majority of pro-impeachment protesters were whiter, wealthier, and more educated than the average Brazilian, earning scorns of elitism from anti-impeachment supporters. One of those at the anti-impeachment protest was Marina Tavares, a 20-year-old public management student at the University of São Paulo. Tavares says that she is not necessarily in favor of Rousseff's government, but is totally against the impeachment process, calling it dangerous for democracy.
There is a lot to lose with an impeachment. First of all, our economic situation could get even worse, as the outside world could see us in an unfavorable light and end trade agreements with us. Secondly, when the right wing controls the country, the marginalized social groups suffer. But perhaps worst of all is that this impeachment could kickstart a series of anti-democratic actions across the world. This is my worst fear.
Pro-impeachment protesters first began camping outside of the Fiesp building after a series of wiretaps of conversations between Rousseff and her mentor, former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, were leaked to the media. Silva had just accepted a cabinet position in Rousseff's government under the pretext that the popular former president would shore up support in the flailing administration. Silva's ministerial position would also help shield him from arrest in the encroaching corruption investigation, Operation Car Wash, that so far has ensnared many of Brazil's top politicians and business elites. Silva denies all wrongdoing and says the investigations against him are politically motivated, an attempt to tarnish his reputation before he supposedly runs for president again in 2018. Critics said that leaking wiretap conversations to the public was a grave violation of Brazil's constitution and that Sergio Moro, the judge in charge of the Petrobras corruption investigation, who released the wiretaps to the media, should face charges. Addressing the press in São Paulo, Brazil's Attorney General, José Eduardo Cardoso, called the leaking of the wiretaps irresponsible and unconstitutional. I cannot think of any country where leaking a conversation of the head of state to the press would be considered acceptable, he said, before adding that such actions have potential to undermine national security. Rousseff, a former leftist guerrilla who was tortured under the military dictatorship, is standing strong, insisting that she will never give up. In a press conference held Thursday for international journalists, she said, "I am not a weak woman." Brazil's political climate has cooled slightly for now after an explosive 2 weeks. The next crucial test will be to see if the controversial and scandal-plagued Brazilian Democratic Movement Party, Brazil's biggest political party, will decide to stay or split with the ruling coalition during a party meeting on the 29th of March. Sam Cowie for FSRN, São Paulo, Brazil.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by stations that air our show and by listeners like you. Visit our website to support our work and to find podcast info and transcripts of stories heard in today's program. Shannon Young provides editorial services from Oaxaca, Mexico. Robert Packard provides technical support from WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Music in today's show is by BDK Sonic via Jamendo.com. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.